This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Perhaps it starts with the small things, needing to know where you'll be or what you're doing or who you're with and what you're wearing. And then it gets bigger and worse. And before you're aware of it, you find yourself in a violent relationship. Discussing intimate partner violence today is clinical psychologist Vizsla Kumarasan. Vizsla, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lin.
So what constitutes intimate partner violence?
Okay, I think the opening that you described, you know, wanting to know where you are, who you're with and things like that, it can escalate into controlling behavior. And that's an aspect of intimate partner violence that's often overlooked. There's a lot of emphasis, there's a lot of focus on physical violence, and that's definitely not a small issue. But there are also other aspects to intimate partner violence, like psychological abuse, emotional abuse, financial abuse, which focuses not only on making the person afraid, the victim in this case, afraid of their partner, and also completely and totally reliant and dependent on the partner as well. So it's a whole range of behaviors from, you know, very slight emotional, psychological, slight in that it may not even be noticed as something that's violence, to the very overt physical abuse.
How would you describe slight? A slight act of violence.
Okay. I think, you know, a lot of us have experienced this as children. Our parents give us a look, and we know that that look means, it speaks volumes. It might mean something as minor as, you've done something bad, sit down quietly, or wait till you get back home, right? And even that also happens with partners. You know, whether it's married couples or just a couple who's dating, a look or a word that to the victim speaks volumes, and they know that something bad is going to happen afterwards. It can be, that is what I mean by slight. Like, it's so, someone who is observing it may not even have realized it.
Does this differ from domestic violence? I mean, we've had tons of conversations about domestic violence. Is there a distinction here?
I don't think so. I think the terms intimate partner violence and domestic violence now is very much used interchangeably. I think with domestic violence, there's an assumption that it only happens in married couples, amongst married couples. I think with the term intimate partner violence, there's a larger framework. So it applies not just married couples. Like I said, it can also happen with couples who are dating, former couples. And it's a whole spectrum of, you know, anybody, and also regardless of sexuality. You know, whether you're heterosexual or you're a same-sex couple, it does happen.
Do we know what the numbers are like here in Malaysia? I mean, I know it's always been a tricky thing because people don't always report and so on, but do we have any sort of gauge?
I am not familiar with the latest statistics. I do know, however, that the Ministry of Women publishes annual statistics, which are available on their website. And I also know that some MPs in Parliament actually bring that up when they have question and answer, and sometimes written answers are produced by the Ministry of Women.
So coming down to kind of the nuts and bolts of it, are there warning signs or red flags that might be present that could indicate your partner has this capacity to turn violent?
I think one of the biggest signs is controlling behavior. Now, there is a very thin line between concern and controlling. And I think a lot of people assume that controlling behavior is concern. It's okay to ask, where are you going? What time will you be back? Who you're with? I mean, these are just general questions we would ask people. The difference between that and controlling is, you might get a phone call every 5 minutes. Are you still there? Who are you with? Send me pictures. you have to call when you've arrived. You have to send a message when you're leaving. You have to send a message when you're on the road. You know, you actually start to feel nervous if you're running late. You've told them you'll be there at 10:30 and it's 10:28 and you know that you're not going to be. So there is a difference, right? Yes, there is the usual anxiety when you're going to be late, but this escalates into actual fear of what's going to happen. So these are all signs that it's not just concern. It's actually controlling behavior. Right. And then you get back home or you meet your partner and you're interrogated about the event that you were at. Who was there? How many boys were there? How many girls were there? What did you say? What did you wear? Did you laugh? It's very, very in-depth. It's no longer a conversation. It is an interrogation. Right. And that is that controlling behavior is a huge sign that the relationship could potentially turn violent. Okay? But then again, violence, physical violence is not the only hallmark of intimate partner violence or domestic violence. There's also psychological violence, emotional violence. If you're constantly being made to feel inferior, you're being called names, there's a systematic exclusion of you from the people you love. So it's not just about controlling behavior, it's also deciding who you go, who you meet, who you can talk to, the person having access to, for example, your phone, your contact details, reading your messages, interrogating you about the messages, deciding who you can see and who you can't see. All those kinds of things also constitute intimate partner violence or domestic violence.
On a separate but somewhat related note, and I'm sure this is going to be familiar to a lot of people, when do you know when to listen to your friends or family when they give you negative feedback about your partner? Because these are behaviors that you might not notice, but your friends might notice if your phone is, just ringing off the hook every 5 minutes. Mm. If you feel the need to take pictures and apologize for it, saying, oh, he just wants to know who I'm with, for example. At the same time, you always think, well, I know him better than others, or I know her better than others. So when do you know that your friends and your family are the people that you need to be listening to?
I think a good gauge is how you feel yourself. Do you feel good about this relationship, right? Yes, relationships go through hard times, but those hard times pass. But when you are in a violent relationship, those hard times don't pass. You always know that it's around the corner. You have a niggling, call it fear. You want to call it intuition, whatever it is, that you know that it's bad for you. And yes, sometimes friends might see a certain side of the relationship. Friends might see, or family might see a certain side of your partner. You know the complete picture. So you're the only one who can make the best decision. However, it's not good to turn away feedback, right? Yes, we all have the over-concerned friend, the over-concerned family member. But I think that's a very clear difference between someone who's overly anxious and someone who's truly concerned about what's going on with you. If you've noticed yourself that you are changing your behavior patterns to suit not just what your partner wants, but because you're afraid of the consequences of not doing so, that is the biggest sign, when you're being guided by fear.
And there is also, I think, an inherent mistrust of a stranger coming up to you and saying, that man you're dating or that woman you're dating, she's not a good person or he's not a good person. What advice do you offer for people who kind of hear this feedback, not just from the people that they love or who love them, but from strangers?
Mm. Well, that would be a huge red flag, isn't it? Like if a stranger just walks up to you and starts telling you things about your partner. The good thing to do would be to actually discuss this with your partner, right? And I think a hallmark sign of danger would be if your partner doesn't want to talk to you about it, right? Or if the partner brushes off your concerns. If they've really nothing to fear, nothing to hide, they'll be able to sit down and have a conversation and answer your questions, give you details. How does this person know you? Why would this person say such a thing? And not hiding information, or you can sense that, you know, the person's being truthful to you, honest, is not, you know, being defensive, that would be a sign that it's perhaps just a strange incident. But otherwise, I think it would be a sign that you need to look at things and start making some really important decisions about your relationship.
There are some people also who believe that the first time your partner expresses violence towards you or acts violently towards you, you should walk away. And here this mostly falls into the category of physical violence, I suppose. If he hits you, if she hits you, you should leave. Would you agree with that, that the first time is the last time?
I think this will, you know, depend on each person and how they view the relationship and how they view each other and things like that. I think the first time is definitely a warning sign. And if that is a person's principle, that the first time is the last time and I'm walking out, that should be respected. But if that's all, that's not someone's point of view, that should also be respected. However, I would suggest that for someone who doesn't take this view that the first time is the last time, they should at least be open to having a conversation with their partner to discuss what are limits of anger behavior, for example. Like, you know, don't hit me again. Or putting a limit on, okay, the next time, and I know it's no longer an accident. Or just having some kind of measure in their minds of when is it not okay anymore.
That leads to a larger question, which is a very fundamental one. Can people who are abusive change? Because you hear these sorts of things thrown around, you know, once a cheater, always a cheater, once an abuser, always an abuser. But for people who are themselves abusers and, you know, kind of going from relationship to relationship, I think for some at least there is a belief that no, this time will be different. For people who love them, there must be that belief as well. From a psychological point of view, where do you stand?
So, you know, there are two sides of me, you know, wanting to answer this question. There is that cynical side of me that says, no, they'll never change. But, you know, that is driven by, that's a very emotional response. I recognize that myself. Psychological evidence, there has been research, there have been successful programs where people charged with domestic violence have actually changed their behaviors. But that has been done through an intensive program that involves both the law and also a medical or mental health fraternity. So it's a combination of multiple things. But the most important factor that will determine whether a person will change is if, number one, they recognize that what they're doing is wrong. Not just because it is going to legally wrong, but that they recognize that what they're doing is actually hurting people whom they love and they care about. And it has adverse effects on other, you know, the larger than themselves. And the other factor is that they are committed to a program that will allow them to change. And this program is not just a 10 sessions of therapy and that's it. You know, it also means support groups after that and a whole system of services that will be able to support the person in changing their behaviors.
I'm speaking today with Vizsla Kumarasan, clinical psychologist. We're discussing intimate partner violence. Up next, we talk a little bit more about the different types of violence aside from physical. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, my guest in the studio, clinical psychologist Vizsla Kumarasan. We're talking about intimate partner violence, one and the same domestic violence, kind of interchangeable. But the point that we were talking about earlier is that there are different types of abuse. We're talking about different dimensions. It's not just physical. We address the psychological part. What about things like stalking? What falls into that category of behavior?
Okay. Stalking would also, it comes in the realm of psychological abuse, right? It's part of it is driven by controlling behavior. And the other part is also to actually instill fear in the person that's being stalked. The intent is very clear. right? And it's basically those two aspects that drive stalking behavior.
When we talk about controlling behavior, I just wanted to float an idea. So there are some people who engage in controlling behaviors, perhaps because that's just how they conduct all their relationships. Mm. That's just what they've been taught to do, or that's what they think they should do. And that's one category of person. But what about a person who finds themselves falling into controlling behavior, who were not controlling before, but now because of whatever, because they're insecure, because of whatever reason, are now finding themselves, you know, listening to you and thinking, my goodness, I fall into that category. How do you stop that? I mean, if you recognize it, how do you go, okay, I don't want to do this?
Yes. Well, I think the most important feature would be recognition, right? And then after that, it would be if a high degree of self-awareness is necessary for you to realize when you're actually enacting controlling behaviors. It's very hard to just overcome that overnight. It's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of conscious effort to change. Controlling behaviors in the kind of, you know, the kind that you're describing is driven by very deep issues. It could be, like you said, insecurity. It could be a fear of abandonment. Like, you know, you think that your partner is going to cheat on you, or any number of, you know, different factors could encourage that kind of behavior. And it is up to that person who wants to change that to seek help to do so. That help could come in the form of mental health support. It could also come in the form of actually just talking to a partner, right? Or even talking to a loved one, a friend, or someone who will help them recognize these behaviors and, you know, have incentives to change.
Another category of violence is sexual violence. And in a relationship, that can be a complex subject for some to understand. What kinds of behaviors are considered sexual violence or harassment when you are in a relationship with someone?
Okay. The most overt form of sexual violence in relationships is when sexual intercourse is either forced or coerced. So when it's forced, I mean, that comes under rape. And many would argue that coerced sex is also rape. Coerced sex is when you are consenting, not because you actually want to participate in the act, but you are afraid of the consequences of not doing so. Whereas, you know, rape, there's this, it's your consent doesn't matter at all. So that's one overt form of sexual violence. Other forms of sexual violence could be, for example, forcing your partner to watch pornographic films or pornographic content when you don't want to. Being involved in sexual talk that you're not comfortable with. Being asked to witness sexual acts between your partner and someone else that you don't want to and you don't consent to in the first place. And a whole range of other things, which involves highly intimate behavior between two people, which is also overshadowed by fear.
We have to talk, of course, about consent in this area. Sadly, one that some people still continue to have problems with as a concept. But for some people, being in a relationship is tacit consent. You know, the fact that we are going out, the fact that we are married, automatically means that you always agree.
It's like a roller coaster ride. You know, you've paid the ticket, you've gotten to the ride, you just have to, you have no control of what happens.
Here we are now, yeah. You know? Yeah. So, I mean, how do we break out of that notion that consent is not given every single time any sort of act is about to take place, but is given, you know, maybe 6 years ago when you first agreed to go on a first date?
Mm. Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that consent is an ongoing process. You know, consent is something that you have to engage in at different stages of your relationship, and it always involves negotiation and renegotiation. What I was okay with 6 years ago may not be okay with me now, or the other way around. And the only way you can decide that is you actually have open conversations. And the fact that you cannot have those conversations, either because you don't know how to, I think if you don't know how to, is a different matter altogether. But you're afraid to have those conversations. That is a big sign that something is wrong with that relationship. You know, if, like I said, if your decisions are driven by fear, that is a big sign that it's not the healthiest of relationships. It's, but you know, it's a potentially violent relationship.
What if it's driven by a fear of being left? I mean, let's say somebody kind of holds that fear of, I'm going to leave you, I will break up with you. So it's nothing to do with, never laid a hand, you know, never did anything of the sort. Would that still fall within psychological?
If my fear of being left is driven by my own insecurities, by my own past, you know, things that happened in my past, it's a very different sort of situation. But if my fear of being left is driven by my partner's constant threats of leaving me, and that is a way of coercing consent, you know, so that is a, that would be a situation of intimate partner violence. That's a very, you know, clear psychological abuse.
When you're working with people who have undergone or been through intimate partner violence, I'm assuming that in some cases, gaslighting has been a part of it. And gaslighting here is, of course, that act of kind of redefining someone's reality. How do you work with that when you're working only with one person whose ideas of reality have been completely kind of overshadowed or reshaped by someone with a special interest in doing so?
Mm. Well, most of the people I've worked with are the ones who have already left the violent relationship and are dealing with the emotional fallout of having been in a relationship and then of actually leaving that relationship. And the issues are very different. In this day and age, people who leave violent relationships still bear the stigma of breaking up the relationship. You know, they're still left with loved ones still say things like, you should have given them another chance. They could have changed. You didn't try hard enough.
What about the kids?
What about the kids? Right. They're those things. Gaslighting, more often than not, is something that happens, something that's done by both the perpetrating partner and sometimes also family members. And oftentimes the family members do it as a way for them to cope with what they know is wrong, right? They might say things like, oh, that never happened. You were just imagining it. I was there too, and this is my version of the events, right? Either because they want to protect the violent perpetrator or they don't know how else to deal with the situation. So gaslighting by that kind of, in that kind of situation can be, it could be a part of that violence, but it may not also, it may also be a way of someone else, another victim, another sense, they are also victims trying to deal with that denial in that sense. And then gaslighting by the perpetrator is again something that's done to perpetuate the violence in that relationship, even when it's over.
Most people's perception of intimate partner violence is that it's perpetrated by men against women. You know, we haven't really been using gendered pronouns, but most commonly that's what people think. Is that a reflection of the actual numbers?
Yes. Worldwide statistics do indicate that largely women are predominantly the victims of violence in relationships, which is perpetrated by men. And, you know, that also mirrors social structures. It's very, very patriarchal structures, which encourage and perpetuate these kinds of violent behaviors as well. However, it does not mean that women cannot be violent in relationships. And violence also happens in same-sex relationships.
What to do, what should you do if you've noticed? So if you're a friend, if you're a family member and you're seeing bruises or you're noticing sort of a change in behavior in this person that you know, what do you do?
So when you're in a violent relationship, it's a very complex situation. You face a lot of guilt, right? Because you might feel that it's your fault. And this is also a part of the psychological abuse by the perpetrator, where you actually feel that it was your fault. You might feel that the partner didn't really mean it. It was an accident, right? That's one aspect. The other aspect is that in many situations of physical violence, it comes at the after a very complex process of emotionally breaking down the victim. So the victim may not even realize that they're going through what they're going through, right? It's a very complex cycle. The victim has lost a sense of self. The victim has absolutely no self-confidence. The victim may not even feel that other people love them, right? That the perpetrator is the only person who's capable of truly loving them. And so if you do notice these things in the person, I think the first thing you have to do is provide them that support, to let them know that they are loved by other people, right? And then slowly to be able to communicate with them that what's happening to them is wrong, that there are other ways of being in relationships, that they can be safe in relationships, that other people, this kind of thing is not normal. That's the other thing, right? And sometimes the victim may not do anything because they don't know that, number one, something can be done, and number two, what to do. Right? So if you are a loved one and you have concerns about a friend, get information yourself, right? Organizations like Women's Aid Organization, AWAM, will be able to provide a whole host of information to let you know how you can support the victim. I would not encourage confronting the perpetrator unless you are confident or truly confident that the victim is willing to walk out with you at any, you know, at that point. Sometimes confronting the perpetrator is not just dangerous for the person, but it's also dangerous for the person in that relationship, because it's going to, number one, increase the violence, and number two, it's going to make the perpetrator even more controlling, and it's going to cut them off even further from loved ones as well and potential sources of support. So for someone who's concerned, it's not just a matter of sitting there and providing a lecture on domestic violence. It's, I think, a series of things that they can do to support the victim.
And for someone listening now who is thinking, I recognize these hallmarks in my own relationship, and they might recognize it, but they might be afraid to speak about what is occurring for so many different reasons, how can they start?
Organizations like Women's Aid Organization and AWAM offer telephone counseling. The safest thing you can do, or the easiest thing you can do, is pick up a phone and make that phone call. If you cannot pick up a phone, if your phone calls are monitored, if you don't even have a phone yourself, you can write a letter, send an email, speak to a neighbor, speak to a close relative whom you trust, a friend, anyone who might even be able to turn to these organizations for help. The important thing is recognizing. Once you recognize it, you can actually, you realize that it's wrong, and then you can decide what you want to do afterwards.
So let's take us through the process, right? I mean, what happens after I sound the alarm? What happens after I speak about it? What is the next step? I mean, if I've called WAO, if I've called AWAM, and now they're telling me, okay, we've got it, what would then happen?
Again, it's up to the victim to decide, right? Using the word victim, it's not the best word, I think, but just so everybody understands, that's the word we'll use. The victim can choose to either go down a legal route or otherwise, right? A legal route would include things like lodging police reports. I think there was a show a couple of weeks ago where someone from Women's Aid said you have to take pictures of the bruises. All those things are very, very important for the legal process. So the legal process would, you know, would follow the kinds of regulations that's enacted in the Domestic Violence Act. There will have to be a court ordered protection order. A social worker will be enlisted to help you through that process. The social worker is usually from the Ministry of Women, but social workers from Women's Aid Organization and AWAM will also be able to help guide you through that process and also provide you the kind of support that you need. If, you know, if there's real fear of the perpetrator where you cannot, for example, go and just stay in your friend's house or go back and stay in your parents' house, organizations like Women's Aid provide shelter. And, you know, the Women's Aid shelter, the location is secret, so no one knows where it is. So it is a safe house in that sense. And after that, you know, there will be, the victim can decide if, you know, she wants to proceed with a divorce or if she wants just a regular separation and then be able to work her way through distancing herself from that partner. It's not that simple because, you know, I think we find that a lot of violent partners don't stop the violence after the relationship ends. The violence can continue even after the relationship has ended. There is stalking behavior. And now the stalking behavior has become even more possible through social media.
And aggressive.
And there's also aggression, right? People can find out where you live. And many people still have to confront their the perpetrators of abuse if there are children involved, when there's visitation, or the other partner wants to be involved in the child's life. And then there's, you know, they might use the children as pawns in this very potentially ugly process as well. So it's very complicated. And the victim will need a lot of support through this whole process. Now, if the victim doesn't want to proceed with the legal route, they can also do other things to, for the lack of a better word, disappear, for example. If you can break it off with your partner, proceed with a breakup. Otherwise, you might just have to pack your things and leave, right? They don't need to go ahead with the legal route. The law does provide protection. It's encouraged for you to go down the legal route. But if you don't want to, and there are many people who have multiple reasons for doing this, they need that social support as well. They need, you know, friends who will be able to provide them rooms to stay in, family who will be able to provide them with temporary shelter, money, right? You may not have a job when you have left the relationship. So all these things also need to be factored in.
If one of your clients is going through intimate partner violence, is it your responsibility as a therapist to inform anybody?
No. Unless, of course, I suspect that there's a real threat to my client's life. If I think that the perpetrator is capable of really causing grievous hurt to my client, then I would lodge a police report. But I would do that after informing my client of my fears and of my suspicions, because I'm not living my client's reality. And after that police report, it's my client who will have to face the consequences. So it's a very thin line. I'd have to talk to them about it. I'd have to tell them what I can do, what I will do. And they would have to have developed a plan. I'm very happy to sit down with my clients and develop plans like this. I'm also very happy to go beyond the call of a regular psychologist to help in that sense as well. But the victim has to be informed and to a certain extent provide consent before I can do anything.
While we've been focusing on women in many ways, for the reasons that we've said above, that it's, you know, much more common, much more prevalent to have that kind of aggression towards women. For male victims, it can understandably be even more difficult to talk about it, to share what's happened. It's a huge blow to your masculinity. How do you recover from that? What is that process?
With a lot of male victims of intimate partner violence, a lot of it is psychological and emotional abuse. There is also physical violence, I don't know what the statistics are, but the literature shows that it's very rarely physical violence. It's mostly psychological and emotional violence. And part of the process of emasculating is part of that psychological and emotional violence. It's part of the strategy to break the person down. And that is also one of the, and it's doubly emasculating because number one, you know, because your masculinity has already been challenged in this relationship. And then for society, you're no longer a real man because you are in this relationship, which is, you know, violent. The process of leaving is not different from what I've already described. In Malaysia, the Domestic Violence Act is gender neutral. It's applicable to men as well as women. And the legal protections are also available and applicable to male victims. But the biggest obstacle is that stigma. How do you recover? A lot of people turn to mental health support to help them recover. But the most important thing is to realize that what they've experienced is not their fault. It is the perpetrator who has the problem, not them, right? And then to just try and regain their sense of self, either through going back into the usual relationships with friends, doing the usual things that they do. And it's a long process. It's not easy. And it might affect their ability to form relationships with other people. But it can be done.
Thank you very much for coming in, Vizsla. I've been speaking with clinical psychologist Vizsla Kumarasan. We've been discussing intimate partner violence today on Live and Learn. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.